Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In March, museums closed, along with everything else. Some have reopened, many have not, and the future of these largely nonprofit institutions is uncertain. A national survey released in July by the American Alliance of Museums found that 33% of museums were not confident they'd make it to fall of 2021. This hour, the future of Iowa's museums and the unique challenges they're facing, including high-tech hands-on exhibits it's no longer safe to touch, and the expense of housing extensive collections even when no one can come to see them. I'll talk with museum directors from the Science Center of Iowa, the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, and the Museum of Danish America. And if you're affiliated with a museum around the state, we'd love to get an update from you as well. Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to start the hour in West Branch with the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Tom Schwartz is the director. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And of course, the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum is an underwriter on Iowa Public Radio. So our listeners have been hearing announcements about the fact that, you are not open to the public. You have not been open to the public since March. Tell me how things are going at the museum.
So, yes, we are still closed to the public. We have been given a phased reopening process, and we were approved to reopen in phase one in July, meaning we could bring back a handful of staff for a limited time to be on site. With the explosion of COVID, with students returning to the University of Iowa, we have been put on pause. Because they look at the metrics not only in Cedar County, where the library museum is located, but also Johnson County, since so many of the staff reside in Johnson County. My guess is that we probably won't be approved to reopen to the public probably until early next year. That doesn't mean, though, that we haven't been busy doing things. Staff have been on 100% telework since mid-March. And for most people, our main function and our main mission is really an archival one. The museum is somewhat secondary to our main mission, but still important. The public knows us mostly through the museum, not through the archive. And so, like most places, we've had to pivot to do programming and our education in long-distance formats, virtual formats, and to rethink in terms of how we do exhibits. So not only do exhibits in a physical setting, but also be able to create a virtual experience as well. And this comes at a, in some ways, a fortuitous time because we are in the process of rethinking of overhauling our permanent galleries. And so this now allows us to think about how we would do that should another pandemic hit, how we would use technology and how we would be able to clean reader boards and all of those things. So in some ways, this has caused us an opportunity in planning for the future of how we would redo the permanent galleries.
Well, and you are in a unique position among the other museums that I'll be talking about today, because this is the official Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. So you are federally funded, right?
Yes and no. Like most things federal, it's complicated. The federal government covers the costs of the facility and the maintenance of the facility, as well as the salaries of most of the staff. It does not cover the costs of temporary exhibits, permanent exhibits, education programs, and public programs. All of that money has to be raised privately or from admissions and museum store sales. We don't really have facility rental because the facility was never designed for that purpose. But most museums are designed with facility rental in mind for receptions and the like. And so that's a very important income stream for most museums.
With thinking about gift shop sales, thinking about taking your programming online, these are things that we're going to hear a lot about from the other museums as well. But you have encountered some unique challenges with taking your programming online because of federal restrictions. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So the preferred platform among educators nationwide is Zoom, and the legal department at the National Archives has indicated that the National Archives educators cannot use Zoom as a primary platform. They can use Zoom if they are a participant in a program on Zoom where they're the primary platform holder is someone other than the National Archives. And so most of our education programming has been done through participating with surrogates. The Presidential Primary Source Project has sponsored many of our education programs. They're the license holder for Zoom. They initiate the program, but we essentially provide the content. And so there are workarounds. Our foundation, we could do programs through them if they use Zoom. They also use Facebook Live. So we have been very, creative in how we have partnerships to get our content out to the broader public in spite of certain barriers for us to be the primary license holder.
As a presidential library and museum, you mentioned that the archive there is really your greatest mission. And there are other museums around the country that have worked really hard to make these archives searchable online in some really exciting ways. Is that something that you're trying to move towards so that even if there is another pandemic, people can still access all of the amazing stuff that you have?
Yes. I mean, obviously, as far as the paper records go, we have been involved for many years in digitizing materials and making them available through the National Archives catalog. And we have also embraced a new software, inventory software, that allows all of the presidential libraries to provide images of their artifacts. At some point, the public will be able to access the artifact collections with those images, again, through the National Archives catalog. And That software, though, will also allow for presidential museums to do virtual exhibits, to do essentially be e-museums. And it's already been piloted at the Franklin Roosevelt Library. The Kennedy Library will be piloting kind of e-museum exhibits. And at some point, those pilots will be made available to the public. So all of the 14 libraries in the system, beginning with Hoover and currently ending with Obama, will have the capability to be able to do these kinds of things. Though it will be some time before they'll be fully functional, simply because camera equipment needs to be acquired. The digital standards have been established for how to photograph collections, but it still takes time. And then, of course, creating all the catalog records. And so there's still a great deal of work, but essentially the foundation exists and it just needs to be built upon.
A great deal of work and a great deal of money. I think one of the challenges that a lot of museums will face in the future is the more digital they become, the more people can access their materials, but people don't like to pay for online content. Museums love to give away knowledge, but that doesn't necessarily put you on a firm financial footing for the future.
Well, but, you know, again, we are a government agency. So tax dollars do support certain of our functions. But this is where having a 501c3 non-for-profit foundation is essential for us and for us making progress, because they can raise funds and support those kinds of initiatives and endeavors where, you know, the tax dollars fall short. I mean, I think what is clear across the board is that government agencies are giving decreased funding by and large, and that's true at NARA.
Well, stay with us just a moment, Tom Schwartz. We're talking about the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch right now. Tom Schwartz is the director. We're checking in with other museums around the state of Iowa throughout the hour. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the uncertain future of museums. Of course, museums all over the country closed in March. Some have reopened, many have not, and the ones that have reopened have had to deal with some unique challenges. The future of museums a few years ago, of course, was all about high-tech interactive exhibits, things that people can touch. And now, touch surfaces are problematic. That's one of the many challenges that museums are dealing with. Right now, we're talking about the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Through the rest of the hour, we'll also talk about the Museum of Danish America, the Science Center of Iowa, the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. And if you are affiliated with a museum and you'd love to share your story, give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Tom Schwartz, director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, before I let you go, tell me what the future looks like to you. You've talked about your complicated funding structure and the fact that you probably won't look at actually opening the museum back up to the public until early 2021, depending on how things go. But what are your greatest fears about the next year or so?
Well, you know, obviously, uncertainty is not something people are comfortable with. And that uncertainty, even when we reopen, will obviously influence whether people feel comfortable making a visit. However, I think, you know, we have every reason to be optimistic about the future. The museums serve a very important function in documenting change over time, and their repositories of human creativity and human achievement. So I don't think that, COVID will destroy museums as having an important place in the future. It does pose, obviously, economic challenges for many, as well as for us. But, you'll find a way to muddle through.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity.
Tom Schwartz is the director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, Iowa. And this hour, as I mentioned, we're checking in with museums around the state. We're going to go out to Elkhorn now in the western part of the state. Tova Brandt is on the line. She's executive director of the Museum of Danish America. Hello, Tova.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you for being here. And of course, you're not in the same position as a presidential library and museum. Tell me a little bit about your funding structure.
Well, we are a private nonprofit, and so we receive no regular funds from either federal, state, or local sources. We are supported basically entirely by our membership base. We're in a position that we have we're a national museum. We're the only museum in the country telling the national story of relations between Denmark and the United States and connections between Danish immigrants in America and their experiences here. We have members in all 50 states. We have visitors from all parts of the country. So we serve our local community as well as the region, as well as the nation. And so we depend on that diversity of support to do what we do.
In March, you closed your doors. What's been happening since then?
Well, we closed our doors, but all of our staff stayed 100% busy. We were able to keep everybody focused and kind of pivot to remote work as appropriate, online programs, online store sales, things like that. We did reopen to the public in mid-July on a reduced schedule. Normally, we're open 7 days a week, but currently, we're open 3 days a week, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. And for us, that makes sense in the current moment because it strikes a balance between kind of the extra staff and the extra kind of protocols and systems that we need to have in place to create a safe and comfortable environment for our staff and visitors, while also allowing us the flexibility on days that we are not open to the public to do work in the galleries, to even have meetings in our lobby. it's been really interesting to think through all of these just basic business operations that we all took for granted, that we can have a staff meeting every couple of weeks and gather together around a conference table. But now we need to gather widely spread apart, and the only place we have the space to do that is our larger public areas. So striking that balance between our operational needs and, the special safety concerns in this time, there's been a lot of adjustments to make.
You have an archive that you're responsible for that you share with the public. Tell me about your thoughts about how to make sure that that is available to the public, even if going to museums isn't safe.
We do try to make our collections available online and had already decided before the pandemic hit that we would make our digital collections database fully accessible to the public for free. It had previously been a membership benefit, but now it's available to the public. And so that's a really wonderful way that people can kind of just browse our collections, can maybe do searches for their own Danish ancestral names, and or if they know that a family heirloom has been donated to the museum, that's been an important asset to make available. We've also begun to develop more virtual gallery tours through 360-degree filming and make those available. So you can take a virtual museum tour and get a sense of what it is like to move through our spaces and move through our exhibitions. And we also have a prairie landscape park, which has continued to be open. Our grounds have remained open for walkers, joggers, bird walkers, watchers, anyone who is looking for interesting places to enjoy the outside, to enjoy the landscape. And so that's been a really wonderful asset, especially this year.
You also take in donations from people on a regular basis, people who have that Danish heritage and have things to share. Has that been affected by the pandemic?
It's been affected a little bit. We saw a real decrease in the number of objects being offered to our museum when we first closed. I think, largely because we were closed, and I think people assumed that there wouldn't be anyone here or anyone to talk to, even by phone or email. We're a bit back to normal in terms of that, although a lot of the physical objects get brought by visitors, and as people travel or not during this time, that pace has been affected. I suspect that we might kind of overcompensate in the future when travel becomes more comfortable for everyone. As people have been spending time at home and perhaps sifting through closets and attics and finding things, and oh gosh, maybe the museum might like this. We might see quite an increase in the coming months.
What do you think you will carry forward? What do you think? Tom was talking about some of the opportunities that the pandemic has created at the Hoover Museum. Do you feel like there are opportunities, things that you've learned that may make your museum even stronger in the future?
I do think so, yes. In many ways, this year has accelerated developments that we'd already been talking about and looking towards, especially in how to engage our national audience. We'd already been talking about the potential of virtual programs, of online content, but had never had the need or the opportunity to invest a lot of staff time and resources into that. Now, that is one of the only ways that we can really reach people and stay in front of people. So that is one way that we really feel like this new plateau of virtual programs, of digital content, not only have we become more experienced at kind of that level of production and creating content in that way, but our audience too has had to accelerate their comfort level in watching programs through Facebook or YouTube or signing into Zoom meetings. We're all so much more familiar with these new technologies. And in another way, too, we had always talked about accelerating our online retail sales as another revenue stream to support our museum. Well, for several months, that was the only potential for retail sales. And so that, too, is a way that we've really learned kind of what are the differences between doing a mail order, an online store, versus when people walk in the door and are there face-to-face. It's a different kind of customer service. It's a different kind of transaction and fulfillment process. And so we've been learning a lot in those areas. And those are probably two areas of the museum that will not go back purely to the way they were, that will probably try to maintain that level of activity on a digital platform.
What are your greatest fears in the next year or so?
One of the biggest challenges for us, especially with our role as a Danish museum nationally and our location in a rural corner of the state is that right now it's really hard for us to meet new people who might become members, who might visit our museum. In a normal year, we are frequently traveling all over the country. We have booths at festivals. We are meeting with Danish-American organizations and communities all over the country. And that keeps us in the path and in the awareness of people who might become new supporters and new audience members. That's the biggest challenge of this year for us, is how do we find the people who would be interested in us if they knew we existed? So that challenge and thinking through just the unknowns of when can we plan major events again? When can we travel again? We're used to planning our calendars months, sometimes years in advance. And that uncertainty of when can we comfortably and safely gather in groups again, that's a major unknown for us.
Well, Tova Brandt, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me, Charity.
Tova Brandt, Executive Director of the Museum of Danish America in Elkhorn. And the next two museums we're going to check in with are museums where things are supposed to be touched. And that is incredibly problematic in the midst of a pandemic. First up, we have Kurt Simmons. He is the CEO of the Science Center of Iowa in Des Moines. Hello, Kurt.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you for being here. And take us back in time to March. Again, you know, everybody closed their doors. What's been going on at the Science Center of Iowa?
Well, we did close our doors, and we slowly had a phased reopening. We reopened the last week of June with just weekend operations. And one of the things that we did was decided to, with our board and staff, kind of lean into the challenges that we have right now. And we had an opportunity to bring in a traveling exhibit, which was pretty risky to do. But we decided to bring in something new to attract folks. And we brought in an exhibit called Sue the T-Rex Experience, which has been doing really great for us.
So visiting the Science Center is something, of course, families love to do, and there is so much to do and learn and touch and experience at the Science Center. Have you had to close some of your permanent exhibits because of the dangers of spreading germs?
We have, and two of our galleries, which are our highest touch areas, we have kept those closed. And what we have done with the exhibits that are open, because we have high-touch areas in just about all aspects of the Science Center,
which normally is a real asset.
It's usually an asset. We want people to come in and push buttons and lift levers and experience physics, but it's a little tough when the pandemic is on. So what we've done is we have a staff member in each of the galleries, and they go through and regularly clean. We've invested in more cleaning services so that we are not just constantly cleaning the exhibits, but we have time ticketing with an hour delay in between the two time ticket windows so that we can go through and rigorously clean the exhibits.
So in having a reduced admission, can you give me an idea how reduced compared to what you would normally experience in a summer?
Yeah. First, nationally, science centers are experiencing reduced admission that's about 10 to 20% of normal for this time of year. So
wow.
Quite devastating. And we were seeing those kind of numbers before we opened our traveling exhibit, which has just been open a couple of weeks now, but we're seeing about 50% of our usual traffic right now, which is really good news during a difficult time.
So, and at 50%, are you having to limit the number of people that are coming in? Are you holding at that 50%, or would you welcome more visitors?
We would welcome more. We can handle quite a few more. We are limiting our time tickets to 25% of the capacity of the galleries, so we still have plenty of room to grow. And we think as word gets out And folks know about Sue being here, that we'll have even more increased attendance, especially as we approach the holidays.
Now, of course, in the spring, I'm sure you missed out on a lot of field trips that, classes would have taken. But during the summer, that's normally a very busy time for the Science Center because of summer camps. And we just have a minute before the break there, but describe what you would normally be doing during a summer.
Usually we're very busy. The summer camps are full. We had about 60% of our capacity with summer camps this year. So we were still able to run summer camps, and parents really appreciated having a safe place to have their kids engaged for the summer. But usually when we're open in the summer, it's one of our busiest seasons, and we see people from all over the country, all 50 states and from around the world. So it was disappointing to be closed for about half the summer this year.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with me, Kurt Simmons. He is the CEO of the Science Center of Iowa. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll welcome another Kurt to the program, Kurt Strand of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. We're talking about the uncertain future of museums right now. You're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the uncertain future of museums. There was a national survey released in July by the American Alliance of Museums that found that 33% of museums around the country were not confident they would make it to fall of 2021. This hour, we're checking in with some of Iowa's museums and talking about the unique challenges they face. With me right now, Kurt Simmons. He is CEO of the Science Center of Iowa in Des Moines. And Kurt, just before the break, we were talking about what you'd normally spend the summer doing, with a lot of summer camps and a lot of teacher training opportunities as well. And you did hold some summer camps. Tell me how you managed that and how you altered your plans to try to make it safe.
Well, we did have to pivot with the summer camps, and the first 2 weeks of summer camp were virtual. So we did those online. We assembled kits of parts for the families that were going to be joining us with summer camp. And our camp counselors led those camps online, and those went pretty well. It's a learning process about how to transform your usual programs to being an effective and authentic experience online. So
everyone is there, experiencing that right now. Yes,
exactly. It's not as easy as just videotaping what you usually do. There's a lot more complexity to it. And that's one of the good outcomes of this whole experience for us, is that we're learning to use different platforms and different venues to be able to get the word out about science education.
Now, I know a lot of teachers were spending time trying to learn how to teach online this summer. You did a lot of virtual teacher training. Was that an element of it, using technology as well?
Yeah, it was. And took a lot of effort to sort of revamp all of our teacher training programs so that they were engaging. You know, to be online for 8 hours at a time, 6 hours at a time, is pretty tough to hold people's attention. So we reworked all of our teacher training programs, and we've had a great summer of supporting the STEM scale-up programs with teacher training, which has gone very well.
So tell me what the future looks like for you. First of all, let's talk about the bottom line. Obviously, you've been hit hard by having far fewer people coming through the Science Center.
Yeah, it's been very difficult. We reduced staff in March. We have put together a long-term plan to get us through 2021 and into 2022. So we've moderated our expenses back a bit, but we think we're still providing great programming for the folks that are coming to the Science Center.
And what are your greatest concerns looking at the next year?
I think I'm hopeful when I look to the future. I know that we're all waiting for some kind of resolution to the pandemic, and we look forward to that here also. But I think as we look to the future, museums in general have another function in our communities, and that is that we are an integral part of the community infrastructure, and people will be looking for opportunities to get out and participate in welcoming community activities. So museums provide that service. It's a great place to go to do and learn and see, but also a great place to exchange ideas and be seen and as part of the community. Well, so I'm hopeful that museums actually have a very important role to play as we start the recovery process.
I know we're all hungry for that kind of engagement again. Kurt Simmons, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Charity. Appreciate it.
Kurt Simmons is the CEO of the Science Center of Iowa. And our next museum is always full of life, even when it's not full of visitors. The National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium President and CEO Kurt Strand is here. Hello, Kurt.
Hello, Charity. How are you today?
I'm good.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. And of course, you have a museum full of wild animals with all kinds of water aquatic creatures that you needed to take care of even when the museum was closed. Is that an additional challenge for you?
That is an additional challenge. We have our historic collections and our living collections. And the living collections, we have over 250 species, over 2,000 different fish and animals. They never are furloughed. They never really take breaks. They need to eat and be cared for. They have life support, high utility costs. And so I think what's interesting about many museums and a combination museum aquarium like us is the fact that you lose revenue when you close, but your expenses don't move down very much,
right?
Which creates a bigger problem.
Yeah. And so tell me how you coped with having to close in March. I know that you have also reopened in some ways. Tell me how things have been going.
Well, we did close on March 17th, and then we reopened on May 26th. When we reopened, we had about 30% of the typical admissions from a previous year at that same time period. We did everything possible to maintain the safety of our property, of our staff, of our animals, and when we opened up our guests. And we, from the day we closed on March 17th, we put together a cross-functional team from different areas, educators, living collections, staff, facilities, et cetera, to help us figure out how to safely open up for our staff, our animals, our guests. And that was quite a process over the course of 2 months. But we felt that once we were ready to open, we could do so in a way that guests would find as a safe place for them to come. And some of the studies of arts and culture organizations is the highest ranking on their list is where they can experience indoor and outdoor activities. And given that we're a 14-acre campus, we have plenty of room for the guests that we typically have visit us.
Did you move any more things outside to give visitors the opportunity to be out there and still engage with your exhibits?
We moved a couple of our hands-on activities outside. We did a really rigorous sanitizing protocol inside and outside of our buildings. And the nice part about us over the course of our three buildings and all the activities outside, there was plenty of space for people to go. And there are hands-on activities outside, a little boat pond and other things, but then just a number of other types of artifacts that we have that allow them to enjoy the museum, but at their own pace, see things inside and outside. We did put together a flow pattern for our guests. We put together areas where they should stop. And we realized pretty early that nobody really comes to the River Museum alone. They typically come as a family. So our spacing was about 10 feet as opposed to the typical 6 feet where they say people need 6 feet of space. We were having our spots where they can view our exhibits and our animals in a larger area, again, with safety in mind. Yeah. We've had very good reviews from the people who have come here that they feel like this is a place they can visit and not really have any types of issues with being too close to people or our staff, et cetera.
In recent years, you have invested so much in these high-tech hands-on exhibits, and you have some really incredibly cool stuff. Did that feel like a cruel irony when you were trying to figure out how to safely reopen that some of the newfangled exhibits were the most dangerous?
Yes, and we had really one complaint out of a whole bunch of people that came here, and the complaint was why they couldn't go into the 4D theater, and it was because we hadn't figured out the protocol for sanitizing the glasses they wear to have that experience. Other high-tech, high-touch activities and exhibits we have, some we closed, and some we would station an educator or a front office staff by that to sanitize between guests. But it is not quite the same experience you'd have if you're coming with your family and being able to run around and touch everything and experience everything.
How did you manage summer camps?
We ended up, at first we weren't sure if we were going to do summer camp, and we polled some members. And then we ended up separating our summer camps into two different groups at a very small number, as opposed to about 20 campers, about 10. And then one would be in one area of the building, socially spaced. One would be in a different area. When we had presentations, they were all sitting on spots far apart from each other. For lunches and other types of activities, they would have their own table. And then when we would bring them through the property to see some of the fish and animals and other experiences, we did so in a way where they were always separated and encouraged to wear masks. But because of the school-age kids, some were very young, that was an optional component for us at that time.
We've been talking to people all over the state, and we know that there are different feelings about the pandemic in different parts of the state. If you polled the public in Johnson County, things might be very different from if you are looking at one of the more rural counties around the state. Of course, you're in Dubuque. Did you have anybody that was frustrated with you for not just fully reopening and allowing visitors the way that you always had?
There was one negative comment on Facebook, and our members actually jumped on and supported us and talked about what we were doing and how we were trying to be safe for everybody, et cetera. That was a very nice feeling for us. We've had tremendous support. So one of the things that I think is interesting is that we are now at about 50% admissions based on the previous year or years, but our museum store is at about 90%. So people are coming in buying more things. And in fact, our museum store staff says, anecdotally will say they are buying extra plush animals or t-shirts, and they'll say, I'm buying more because I know you need our support.
Oh, wow.
So we are blessed to have a community that has been supporting us in this manner.
You have also come up with some creative ways to engage with the public more online, which, of course, doesn't mean extra expenditures and probably doesn't mean any more money coming in. But tell me about some of the unique things that you've been able to do this year to really connect with people while they haven't been able to visit.
We have done virtual education programs for a small fee, which has helped generate a little bit of revenue. But some of the ways that we've tried to keep in contact with our members, our guests, people who have either seen us in the past or are searching for us, is we created an otter cam. Our two otters are both about 2 years old, and they are amazing. And at rivermuseum.com, you can go and watch them. I've had people tell me that they have one monitor in their office on otter cam and they work on the other one. I don't know if I'd encourage people to do that, but it does say that people are really enjoying it.
That's I already
we have a
have
Mississippi
some
River cam,
with
which is
with
great
the,
because you see barges go down. Sorry.
I was just going to say I already have some problems with focus when I'm working from home, but
well, I was told I should just move my desk down in front of the otters because I'm down there so often. We also do have a 360 tour that we have created for our Mississippi River Center for people can experience that. And we did a number of short 3 to 4 minute educational programs. Could have been about a different animal, our kestrel hawk, from our Victorian home, how to make cornbread, a variety of different YouTube short videos that have been shared a large number of time. And we also found out our Facebook followers have gone up approximately, I think, about 25% since we closed, that people were experiencing us via all the posts and social media and the things that we were doing that gave them the taste of our property while they're at home waiting this thing out.
Well, now I'm watching otters as we speak. And let's look to the future, because as you said, you're still at about 50% of the number of visitors that you would normally have. And those ticket sales are a really important part of how you operate. So what does the future look like?
I think in many ways, we will have guests that we're slowly creeping up on admissions. And I think what's happening is they're finding out or feeling safer about going out, especially if they have the kind of experience when they come here to see that they can stand and see all of our exhibits, but do it safely and separated. And the word of mouth for me is pretty positive. I think the issues we're going to face are the financial component of sustainability when your utility bills, your essential workers, the people who care for our, and feed and take care of our animals and our collections and all those other kinds of things. And then potentially what else can happen, hopefully not a second wave, but if in fact we would need to close down the future, how would we handle that as an organization? So the financial sustainability and then also the sustainability of what we have here that we offer. Our board is very supportive, and one of our board members said, whatever you do, don't get rid of the thing that makes you special. Your educators on the floor, the way they love when guests are coming around, and those experiences that they have, that interpretation in different ways, those are the things I think that set us apart. So, and it gives me hope for the future. I think the other thing is that we've really been working a lot on partnerships. So partnerships with local schools, partnerships with other areas, for us to help them experience what we're doing, but then also to provide educational experiences for them, either in their schools or on our campus. So those things, to me, give us opportunities going forward to really turn this around. But I think it's probably going to take a little bit of time for us to get to that stage.
Well, and so many people are worried about what's going to happen going into the winter months when there are fewer opportunities to learn and spend time outside. I'm sure that's a concern for you as well. And, you know, Kurt, we've talked to larger museums around the state of Iowa this hour. I also worry a great deal about the smaller museums and whether they will make it through this as well. Do you have any words that you want to share with people who love their local museums and maybe need to be spending a little more time thinking about them, even if they can't visit?
I think there are ways to experience this, and it could be, as one of them mentioned, you buy something from their museum store. I think there's other ways to do that by going online and sharing, if they post social media, sharing it. But when they do open, a visit, a safe visit is really important, because we found out, as using otters as an example, when we didn't have guests, the otters started to sleep more, they ate more. When our guests came back, it was almost like, oh, thank you, you're back here. And our staff needs it, our animals need it, and the visit, the personal visit and or reaching out, are very important for all the museums around.
Well, Kurt, thank you so much for being here today, and best of luck to you and to everyone involved in museums in Iowa.
Thank you.
Kurt Strand is president and CEO of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. We've been talking about the challenges that museums are facing, trying to operate and trying to stay solvent in the midst of a worldwide pandemic. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Dennis Reese. You never need to miss a show. You can subscribe to our podcast. Just search for Talk of Iowa anywhere you get your podcasts. And we always love to hear from you. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbie.